Good afternoon. I'm Paul Seabee on behalf of the appellant taxpayers. Appellants in this case are coal mining companies involved in the exploration, production, and development of coal in the state of Colorado. All of these companies pay the coal severance tax in Colorado and are also members of the Colorado Mining Association, which is also appellant in the case. This case is about the Taxpayer Bill of Rights Amendment to the Colorado Constitution, approved by the voters in November of 1992 and made effective immediately thereafter. Right after the adoption of TABOR, the Colorado, and 14 years thereafter, immediately thereafter, and reaffirmed by the Executive Director of the Department of Revenue in 1998, the Department continuously and correctly interpreted TABOR and its duties under TABOR, freezing the upper rate of the coal severance tax rate at 54 cents per ton. In 2007, the Department of Revenue did an about-face and via the Challenge 2007 rulemaking, increased the severance tax rate on coal by 40%, raising it from 54 cents a ton to 76 cents a ton without first obtaining the approval of Colorado electorate. TABOR Section 20, Paragraph 1 supersedes, though, and repeals any state law or rule that conflicts and authorizes what TABOR otherwise forbids, and that is the increase in taxes, as existing taxes, or the authorization of new taxes without first obtaining voter approval. This case is unique because it deals with a tax rate the department is increasing by application of a statutory formula, something this court has not addressed, nor has the state Supreme Court.
How many other taxing statutes have a similar, or essentially a ministerial formula built into them?
Judge Webb, we're not aware of any other.
So this may be a unique statute?
That's our understanding. We've looked at that issue extensively and hopefully exhaustively, but have not found any other such statutory formula.
Thank you.
And Mr. Seavey, what section of Section 20 supersedes any pre-existing statutes that may have an existing tax increase mechanism in it?
Section 20 superseding provision applies to the Colorado Coal Severance Statute adopted in 1977, which contained the formula, which allowed for adjustments in the upward adjustments or decreases, for that matter, in the coal severance tax rate. And because the department is applying that in 2007 to upward adjustment, a increase in the tax rate, that is what's prohibited and superseded.
So the taxpayers get the benefit anytime the PPI decreases the tax they pay, but as soon as the PPI increases it, they can assert the statute's invalid?
They get the benefit, and that was the department's interpretation immediately after TABOR was adopted. They issued a notice to all of the Colorado coal taxpayers that said, until further notice, the rate shall be 54 cents. What that meant was, and they went on to say that in 1998 when they reaffirmed that decision, was that it could go down. The PPI could go down because the PPI, of course, is a national index of this aggregate of selling goods in the United States all throughout the country. It's not linked to coal. Mm-hmm. But so, yes, Judge, it could go down.
And they would get the benefit of that?
Yes.
But as soon as it goes up, they can challenge it?
Yes, because that would be a tax rate increase from where the tax was previously. Standard review in this case, of course, is de novo. The department violated TABOR in two independent respects, the first being that it increased the coal severance tax rate without first obtaining a vote of the electorate, and second, it instituted a tax policy change that resulted in a net revenue gain to the department without a vote of the people. Because the department did not follow TABOR's requirements, the relief we seek is asking the court to set aside the 2007 rulemaking and to declare that under TABOR, the coal severance tax rate cannot exceed 54 cents a ton. The department responds to this challenge by suggesting it's not a district under TABOR, and therefore TABOR requirements prohibitions don't apply. That's an incorrect argument because the term district is defined adequately in TABOR and extensively as, quote, the state or any local government. It goes on to say it does not include enterprises. The department, of course, is not an enterprise. TABOR's definition of district is not limited just to the legislative branch as the state now asserts.
I may have missed that argument. I'm not sure where they said we're not, that relied on the district language. I saw them say that we don't set policy, we're just ministerial implementing the statute. I didn't see them say we're not a district, and we can ask Ms. Marquez if she's going to argue, but...
Sure, that's, Judge Connolly, that's our understanding of their argument in their response brief. They are a district, clearly, Tabor, and the definition of district applies not just to the legislative branch, but also to the executive branch. The department is an executive branch agency. Colorado Constitution Article 3 says the state of Colorado consists of three distinct branches, and therefore the use of the term state and the definition of district equally extends to the executive branch. With respect to the tax rate increase argument, the department failed to obtain voter approval for increasing the rate, as I said, by 40%. The department seeks to distract the court with an argument that the tax rate is really just the formula and nothing has changed, and therefore this is authorized and there's no Tabor defect. Tabor, though, applies to all tax rate increases that occur after its effective date, including those that result from the application of the formula in this instance. This formula does not fit within any of the narrow exemptions in Tabor, and that the only way to look at this properly is to ask the question and focus on what is causing the tax rate to increase, and that is the fluctuation of the PPI. Were it not for the fluctuations in the PPI and the department's actions to implement those fluctuations, there would be no tax rate increase, but that is exactly what has happened here. The PPI fluctuated up, and the department took it after 14 years of suspending it because of its Tabor interpretation, and then applying it and levying the tax.
If they had taken it and applied it the opposite direction, if the PPI had gone down and it had decreased the amount of the tax, would the department have been able to do that?
Absolutely.
Under Tabor?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's not an increase. Tabor doesn't prohibit or require the electorate approval of decreases in taxes. The point about the PPI fluctuation and the department applying that now to cause and be the sole cause of a tax rate increase those activities are reflected in the regulation where, quote, the rate shall be adjusted each quarter based upon changes in the PPI, and that could go up or down, but obviously we're talking about up. And the statute similarly talks about the executive director shall determine such adjustments to the rate based upon changes in the PPI. The department says that this is no different than the unemployment tax, but it is very different than the unemployment tax. And the unemployment tax context discussed in an attorney general opinion that they cite, 93-3, all of the variables that caused the tax obligation there for the employer to go up were within the control of the employer, the number of employees, the salary of the employees, the days worked, and so on. All of the factors here in the severance tax situation are outside the control of the taxpayers.
Can you see 93-3 is correct?
If you, Judge Connolly, if you look at the very last paragraph of 93-3, that is where it applies to our case. And it says, it recognizes that where there is a change or, quote, increase in the standard or computed rates of a tax, then voter approval is required. Here, the standard that is changing is the PPI. And the department now using it to increase, publish, and levy and assess an increased tax rate. That is the circumstance that 93-3 General Norton recognized would trigger the voter approval requirements. The department also asserts that the Supreme Court's decision, the state Supreme Court decision in Bolton, does provide a sweeping exemption for unique mechanisms like this that existed prior to Tabor's adoption. It does not provide such a sweeping exemption. In fact, Bolt affirms that Tabor applies to, quote, new or increased taxes imposed on or after November 4th, 1992. This is a increased tax applied after the Tabor's effective date. The department also exceeded and violated Tabor, as I indicated in the introduction, by instituting a tax policy change that resulted in a net revenue gain. In 1993, immediately after Tabor's adoption in late 92, the executive director, the head of the agency, looked at Tabor's occurrence and said it has an effect on this program, this tax statute, and determined that the policy to establish as a result of the constitutional amendment was to suspend the tax from exceeding 54 cents a ton.
I'm having trouble with that argument. I don't think the department ever made in 92 or 3 or in 07 when they reinstated a policy judgment. It wasn't really a legal judgment that the Attorney General really prompted and said, you have an obligation, an obligation to execute the law passed by the legislature and to enforce the law as the legislature wrote it. I don't see any policy judgment. It seems a legal judgment, but I don't see any policy that this is good or bad tax policy. I'm missing that policy angle here.
Sure. The documents in the record, of course, are the 93 notice to the taxpayers from the Department of Revenue that articulate the enactment of Tabor, the adoption of Tabor, and then articulate by the department the application of that circumstance, the constitutional amendment. That fits within the authority that the General Assembly vested in the executive director as the chief authority of the state and advisor of the governor and the General Assembly in matters of collection of taxes and the enforcement of the taxing and licensing laws, and shall have such powers and duties as are necessary and proper to carry out those functions.
So they have to carry out the policy set by the legislature, don't they? They're not making policy in this area.
In this instance, that legislature policy was superseded by the will of the electorate of Colorado. And and the executive director was announcing that to the taxpayers. And so, you know, you referred to it as a legal discussion. It's a legal policy. And it's a policy as the application of the law with respect to them as obligees of the tax. And they were being informed of the circumstance relative to their rights and responsibilities. That, I call that a policy. And it was articulated to them, and that was the circumstance. And or you could also say that if it wasn't the executive director announcing the policy, it was the electorate of Colorado by amending the Colorado Constitution announcing the tax policy, that the executive director was merely acknowledging and adjusting thereto. Either way, it was an affirmation provided to the taxpayers, and that's again what happened in 1998, a written document also in the record where there is a recounting of the circumstance and the affirmation that, hey, we made the right decision in 1993, and it goes on to say that fluctuations can only go down. And so in the rulemaking, in which we obviously were parties, we asked the Department of Revenue to conduct a fiscal analysis. They refused, and so we retained Dr. Tucker Hart Adams, a noted economist in Colorado, to conduct a fiscal analysis using the Tabor subsection formula. And Dr. Adams found that the severance tax increase associated with the then later enacted or promulgated regulation resulted in an 11.7 increase in the revenues in the first quarter of 2008 alone, net revenue gain. The department at the hearing in the district court conceded net revenue gain, and so it's not a disputed fact. Normally, you would think the department should be the entity that prepares the fiscal analysis to demonstrate where the tax fits relative to the subsection 7 issue. Mesa, the Supreme Court's decision in Mesa had not been decided during the rulemaking, but we followed the Section 7 provision, and indeed the Supreme Court in the Mesa case, school finance case a year or so later, did that, instituted that as an opinion that said tax policy change is a catch-all phrase, and it has to be linked to Section 7, and indeed that's what we did in the rulemaking and provided to the department. They didn't do one. So all we have is what we did, and it shows affirmatively the net revenue gain by, as I said, 11.7%. There is no dispute in this case that there is a 40% increase in the rate of tax. The last point the department makes in defending its actions is, gee, we just did this wrong for 14 years, and we're only correcting it. And the only legal authority they cite for that is the Woodman case, and a case that did not involve Tabor, was decided prior to Tabor, and only involved clerical staff correcting the application of an assessment mistake. That's far different than the actions by the executive director here, or indeed the electorate of Colorado in announcing the nature of Tabor. So I have 25 seconds left. I'll sit down unless there's any further questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, the council. I'm Monica Marcus, attorney registration number 28950. I'm with the Colorado Attorney General's Office, and I appear today on behalf of the defendants, Roxy Huber, the Department of Revenue, and the state of Colorado. With me at council table is Deputy Attorney General Maurice Kneiser. Your Honors, before I address the specifics of plaintiff's arguments on appeal, I'd like to make two points that provide a framework for analyzing this case. First, under the Supreme Court's decisions in Barber versus Ritter and the recent Mesa County decision, the statute that underlies the department's regulation here is entitled to a heavy presumption of constitutionality. So in order to prevail here, plaintiffs bear the burden of proving that the statute on which the regulation is based is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Second, it's a fundamental constitutional principle that the power to tax and to amend laws is vested with the legislature. By fundamental constitutional design, the state's power of taxation and hence the associated power to establish tax policy for the state is inherently and exclusively a legislative function. That appears in the Pueblo Junior College case we've cited, the Stanley versus Pittsburgh mining case. Certainly, the executive branch may administer the tax laws and may implement the tax policy that is established by the legislature, and the judiciary, of course, may likewise interpret the tax laws passed by the legislature. But under basic separation of powers principles, neither the executive branch nor the judicial branch is vested with the power to tax in the first instance, and neither branch may usurp that core legislative function. And I think this overarching principle is key both to understanding Tabor and to analyzing the claims here raised by plaintiffs. Unless the court has any immediate questions, I will first address the tax policy change argument and then turn to the tax rate increase. Plaintiffs claim, of course, under the tax policy argument that the regulation represents a tax policy change directly causing a net tax revenue gain to the department as a self-contained district, and that the department was therefore required to submit its regulation to a vote of the people in a statewide election. There are two components to this claim. Plaintiffs first need to show that this regulation constitutes a tax policy change. And then second, assuming that it is a tax policy change, that this tax policy change directly caused a net tax revenue gain to a district.
Does it have to be a tax policy change in order to trigger Tabor, and if as long as it's a tax increase?
Plaintiffs, I raised the net revenue gain in connection with plaintiff's specific tax policy change theory of the Tabor violation here, but plaintiffs separately contend that the regulation represents a tax rate increase.
Right. Is the first necessary for the second? In other words, if it's a tax rate increase, does it matter whether it was a tax policy change?
No. There are independent theories of violations of Tabor.
Thank you.
Our view is that the tax policy change claim fails because the department's regulation is not and cannot be a tax policy change in the first place. And consequently, the trial court did not need to reach the second half of that inquiry, whether there was a net tax revenue gain to any district. Fundamentally here, the department as an executive branch agency cannot set statewide tax policy. As I noted earlier, by constitutional design, the power to tax is vested with the legislative branch, an elected body that is representative of the people. The power to tax, of course, then includes the equally inherently legislative power to establish tax policy, to decide who and what shall be taxed and how tax liability shall be determined.
Ms. Marquez, do we have to go that far to reject the challenge? Do we have to say you can never set tax policy, or can't we just say in this particular instance you did not set tax policy, you, the department, did not set?
I think, you know, our fundamental position here is that an executive branch agency, a state board, a state commission can't, as a matter of separation of powers principles, can never set tax policy.
Well,
but in this case, in terms of a narrow ruling here, it's especially clear in this case that there was no tax policy set. And that's because this specific statute gave the department no discretion whatsoever. It set forth a formula and mandated that the department basically calculate that formula as a mere ministerial function. There was no discretion delegated to the department regarding whether to follow the formula, how to apply it, when to apply it. All of that was laid out in the statute, and the department's sole function in this regard was to calculate those PPI adjustments and announce that computed nominal rate to the industry.
Can I jump ahead to the tax rate issue? I know you haven't exhausted all your arguments on tax policy, but it seems to me that it, just on a plain language, the tax rate in 92 pre-CABR was 54 cents, and if you look at the department's tax coal rate chart on the website that you cited us to, it says in January 08 it's 76 cents, and it's fluctuated since then, I understand. But, you know, why isn't the tax rate the number instead of the formula? That's what I'm kind of struggling with. In any common sense way, if you ask somebody in the industry or ask me or anybody else, you say, what's the tax rate? I think most people would say tax rate in January 08 is 76 cents a ton.
Remember, the short answer to your question is that the tax rate here is the formula enacted by the legislature. That formula, which was enacted well before the passage of TABOR, has remained the same. The longer answer to the question is that tax rate, the phrase tax rate, is not defined in TABOR. But the everyday use of the word rate can mean several different things. It can apply to a base rate, meaning a particular component of a tax formula. It can apply to a nominal rate, meaning the product of that tax formula. It can also mean a formula rate itself, the formula by which the tax burden is calculated.
But the department's own website has something called coal severance tax rate, and it says tax rate, and it says January 08, 76.
And perhaps that's some loose language, I think that specifically what that's referring to is the nominal rate. Under the fundamental principles of TABOR, I think the best approach here is to view tax rate as the method of calculating a tax burden as that has been established by the legislature, and not necessarily the actual tax burden that is expressed in dollars and cents. The legislature sets tax rates in a whole variety of ways, but they're all formulas. The tax burden could be X percent of sales volume, X percent of gross income, an experience ratio, or some formula based on capital utilization in a given industry, or here, a base rate plus an inflationary index component. It's quite possible that an individual tax burden can fluctuate from year to year, but the tax rate itself doesn't change. So again, when you have, for example, a Colorado income tax rate is based on Colorado taxable income, which is derived in part from federal taxable income. Well, that federal taxable income is set in federal law. There might be a change in federal law that would shift, if you will, your federal taxable income, which in turn then adjusts your Colorado taxable income. The rate, however, at the end of the day, even though you might pay more or less, the rate set in Colorado law, that formula has not changed.
I can accept that. Your argument is the burden may increase, and if you tax per ton of coal and you produce 100 tons 1 year and 1,000 tons next year, your burden's going to increase, but the tax rate won't. I can accept that, and I think 93.3 seems to be saying that. I think your hypothetical about the income tax burden may increase, but Judge Webb asked before, are there any other formulas? So yes, to your opposing counsel, are there any other formulas that would be affected under this theory? Are there any other?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the details of any specific formulas. I have been made aware that a limited gaming tax scheme might operate in a similar fashion, and that until recently, the unemployment tax formula operated mostly similarly to the way that it is expressed in the 1993 AGO. However, in this past legislative session, it's my understanding that all of that has been converted to an enterprise and is now for completely exempt from TABOR. So I'm not aware of any series, and as counsel also indicated, I'm not aware of a whole fleet of statutes that operate.
So you don't have a parade of horribles argument to make?
Unfortunately, I do not.
Ms. Marcus, getting back to what's a tax rate, et cetera, what do we do with the language from the Supreme Court's decision in Bruce that says a tax increase that requires an election under TABOR is, quote, a change that will impose a greater cost on the taxpayer? If we use that definition, isn't this a tax rate increase?
Your Honor, I think we responded to plaintiff's arguments under Bruce in some detail at pages 40 and 41 of our answer brief. But to summarize those responses, our main points there are, one, the Supreme Court in that case was examining tax rate increase in the context of looking at the election provisions in Section 3 of Tabor and not the voter approval provisions in Section 4. So it was focused on the election piece and not necessarily Section 4, which is at issue here. Secondly, the court really focused on changes in the legal status quo in that case at page 995. This approach then is consistent with this overarching theme that, you know, voter approval provisions of Tabor have been construed to apply to changes in the legal status quo after November 4th. In this case, the legal status quo has not changed. The formula set in place years ago before Tabor has remained the same. And then finally here, another, I think, principle articulated by the Supreme Court in Bruce that I think is relevant here is that this formula does not evoke the specter of unchecked government growth, which is one of the concerns set out in Tabor. This formula not only tracks a larger economic index, but it prevents that nominal rate from ever outpacing inflation. By design, the rate will never even keep up with inflation. It's designed to stay within those bounds. So it's our view that the formula doesn't implicate the broader concerns contemplated by Tabor. And again, those basic points are articulated at pages 40 and 41 of our answer brief. I would certainly agree that if there were, in fact, a, you know, legislative action taken here to change some component of the formula by raising the base rate or adding a new component to the formula, changing those indexing amounts, moving it to an entirely different index altogether, any aspect of that would alter the formula, the structure itself, and that could be a Tabor event requiring voter approval. I also note, though, that any of those changes would require legislative action. The department has no authority to do that.
Let me ask you this, Hatzari. If the legislature had said in 1991 the tax rate on per ton of coal is 54 cents, it's going to go up a penny a year, how does that statute survive or not survive Tabor?
I think that under Bull, that statute would survive because, again, what the legislature has done is set in motion a series of events set to happen automatically. That's a closer call than here because the statute is setting forth defined increases, whereas what's happening here, I think, was unique and perhaps, in our view, relevant to the analysis here is that this fluctuation under 3929.106 is a very hands-off approach. It is tethered to external events that are outside legislative control. But again, the fundamental piece here is that Tabor was designed to take from the legislature this inherently legislative discretionary choice to raise taxes and move that into the hands of the people. Where there is no inherently legislative discretionary act being taken, Tabor is not implicated. I will also note that plaintiffs suggest that the department was somehow required to conduct a fiscal analysis here, and this was part of an APA claim that they lost below and did not raise on appeal. To the extent plaintiffs suggest that a Tabor analysis was required prior to promulgating the regulation, they don't point to any provision in law requiring this type of analysis. But in any event, the department here affirmatively went to the Attorney General's office and sought a formal Attorney General opinion that laid out that Tabor analysis. That formal Attorney General opinion was what gave the department a green light, if you will, to go forth with its regulations. Unless the court has any further questions, in sum, the plaintiffs here cannot show that the department's regulation is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. So for the reasons stated in our answer brief and argued here today, the defense respectfully asks that this court affirm the ruling below. Thank you.
I have very little time left, so I'll be very quick here and just a few points. Judge Conley, you asked where in the department's response brief they raised the point or assertion that they're not a district. I would please call your attention to page 23.
I did see it. I think it was in a different context, but that's correct. And thank you.
No problem. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Just two, maybe three points. The power to tax since the beginning of our country has obviously been vested in the legislative branch. The federal constitution, the state constitution have an origination clause requiring all bills that would cause or impose a tax to originate in the people's house, the House of Representatives. There's a reason for that. It's very historic. We all know that.
Counselor, your time is exhausted.
All right, thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course. And since that exhausts our docket, the